From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 61 for Friday, the 3rd of January, 2012. On the show this week, Facebook goes public in a $5 billion offering for the first time ever. The Pirate Bay sadly lose their appeal to avoid jail time. And what's the story behind Tumblr? Wired Magazine's Tom Cheshire joins us to explain the inside story. All of that and more coming up. Ahoy, and of course, hoy, I'm Nate Langson, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me this week in the Trinket Cupboard, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And for a very special appearance, Tom Cheshire from Wired Magazine.
Hello, everyone.
The print version of Wired. Tom, you're going to be joining us in a little bit to talk about Tumblr, I believe. The world's most incredible not-blog success story.
Yes.
I'm glad we... Okay.
But that's all to come.
It is to come. Well, we've got a bunch of stuff to get through. Tom is going to join us for the duration of the show. Thanks, Tom. Very kind of you. And the first thing we're going to talk about is Facebook, which has gone public. You can buy... Well, consume buy shares in Facebook.
You can buy Facebook.
Live. This is big news.
It is big news. This is the biggest IPO in tech history. It would value Facebook at around $100 billion. $100 billion, yeah. And in the stock you'll be able to buy fairly shortly, I believe.
Now, that's more than Google when it went public in 2004.
Four times more than Google when it went public. Google in 2004 was valued at $23 billion. Now it's worth around $188 billion. So still more than Facebook, but Facebook's fast catching up.
And more than Amazon.
And more than Amazon, $88 billion for Amazon.
So who'd have thought? I mean, they've got, what, just under a billion users now, I think. 845 million users.
Yes, that's right.
It's kind of, in that sense, doesn't surprise me that they're worth so much. You've got all these people piling all this, you know, personal information. It's an advertiser's dream. We are Facebook's product, essentially.
I mean, on the other hand, every time that Facebook tries to do something with that information, there's a huge, great big outcry and privacy panics all over the web. So
yeah, but that's
how valuable is that information if they can't do anything with it?
Well, they have been doing something with it, and they've made $3.71 billion in 2011. So they're obviously managing to monetize those users in some way. But
yeah, but
still,
the thing is as well, that $1 billion of that last year was profit.
Yeah, exactly. So they're in profit. They're doing well. No one knew if they were profitable or not until this filing. So I think no one's going to be losing any sleep over Facebook's fate.
Yeah. So without going too much down investor alley, there are a few other things that came out of the filing with the SEC. And one of them, which interests me most, is that Zynga, that's the company that does Farmville and I think, is it Cityville or?
A bunch of other social games. Gargaville, I think, is one of their products.
A bunch of Vills. They account for 12% of Facebook's annual revenues. Now, that's a huge, huge number, to the extent that they even mentioned Zynga in their filing, that if like something went wrong with a relationship with Zynga, then finances would be troubled.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty incredible. That's an amazing symbiosis at work there.
Absolutely. And other things that were of note were the fact that half of all Facebook users access it on a mobile device. But unfortunately, there are no ads on Facebook mobile at the moment. So they're potentially losing a lot of money if people are going to be shifting into mobile. And finally, I guess the fact that Zuckerberg owns a massive 28.4% of the shares.
Yeah.
And still has a huge majority when it comes to voting in the boardroom. So he's not going to lose any control after this deal.
So just having a look at how this can affect things for people in the street moving forward, one of the things I noted is that Facebook is considering sponsored posts a little bit like Twitter. You know, on Twitter, you can get these sponsored, basically sponsored tweets that if you do a search for a particular topic, you can get, say, if you mention coffee purely out of as an example, you might get a sponsored tweet from Starbucks saying discount on, you know, lattes or whatever.
Yeah.
Something like this sounds a bit like Beacon to me. Putting stuff in your newsfeed without your will.
I mean, I guess the thing is people are going to be really worried that Facebook's going to become much more aggressive to make more money because they've got shareholders to answer to. But I think any investor worth their salt will realise that you don't want to piss off the users of Facebook. Like, that Facebook lives and dies on its community, and that it's a powerful community. But on the flip side of that, it's so powerful and has such big scale that people are less likely to leave because all their friends are on it. So I think we could take a bit more aggressive advertising, to be honest, and people will put up with it.
Well, we'll leave it there. If there's anything you want to learn about the Facebook IPO, what it means for you, Liv has done a couple of stories on the site, but I think the most interesting one is Facebook IPO, what it means for you, or words to that effect. I think if you search Facebook IPO on wired.co.uk, yeah, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff. Cool. So Pirate Bay, not good news bears. They're not having a happy picnic right now. They have had their appeal to escape jail time turned down. It's off to prison they go. Duncan.
Yes. The Supreme Court of Sweden has announced that the founders won't be able to appeal their prison sentences or their fines, and that makes those rulings effectively final within Sweden. Fredrik Nietzsche is getting 10 months, Carl Lundström is going to get 4 months, and the fourth defendant, who lives, I think, somewhere in South Asia and hasn't been seen in quite some time, Gottfried Svartholm, didn't turn up to the hearings, but has got a one-year jail sentence.
Not a great move on his part. I mean, they have to pay collectively £4.3 million, 46 million kroner. They're never going to pay that.
It seems very unlikely that full figure is going to be recouped for the prosecution, for the content industries. But I think obviously the point here is to make a statement and to shut this site down beyond belief. But the funny thing is, it's not going to get shut down.
No.
These guys don't run the site anymore. It's owned by an entirely different group of people, and it's online as we say this podcast.
That's the thing. They've actually moved the domain as well. So I think it's now under a Swedish domain name. I think piratebay.se or thepiratebay.se, something like that. So it's kind of, does this not suggest that we don't need stuff like ACTA and SOPA, which we've talked about in great detail over the last couple of weeks? I mean, Liv, this all strikes me as being entirely pointless now and a waste of money.
Well, it doesn't, because if you can see the amount of monies that are being recouped here, it's 4.3 million. That's from the Swedish record labels, isn't that right, Duncan?
Yeah, and movie studios and things. I can't remember exactly who the prosecution were.
So if SOPA got passed, it would make it easier for the US to enforce their own legislation on foreign infringing sites such as the Pirate Bay. And they, if we look at a case like Mega Upload, they were saying that it had robbed them of 500 million in kind of copyrighted material.
I think the key thing here is all of these numbers are nonsense in the first place.
They're
based on a download is a lost sale and various damages on top of that, and that's clearly rubbish.
But that doesn't matter when you've got the power of ridiculous legislators and ridiculous copyright holders who have huge amounts of money to pursue these cases.
Well, Peter Sund, who actually spoke at our conference last year, posted quite a personal blog on his own website, and there's an excerpt that I'm going to read, and he says, "I'm just one of many millions standing up against this. Even though the outcome, which we still haven't reached, is not favourable for my personal situation, the end goal that we fight for is so much more important than some people's personal struggles. I'll live with not being rich, which is easy when you're not rich anyhow, the rest of my life. I'll live with whatever sentence I'll get in the end. I'll just finish my book. The fight goes on with or without me. I'm just a pawn. But at least I'm a pawn on the morally right side. I'm proud as hell of what I've done, and I would not change my involvement in any way. I actually think I could have done much more for the fight, and I will." Pretty strong words.
It's very, very strong words. I mean, it's clear that there's a large generation of people within Europe and the States and all over the world that feel very, very strongly that the legal system has grown completely out of touch with how people consume content on the web these days.
Well, let's turn our frowns upside down and talk about the reproductive systems of arachnids. Liv, you wrote a story today that involved us posting a picture of a spider on wired.co.uk with a slightly severed penis on it. A spider penis.
That is correct. Evolutionary biologists have been studying spider sex, and more specifically, they've been looking at spiders who have sexually aggressive behaviours, and that's the cannibalistic orb web spider. Now, what happens when these spiders have sex is invariably, I think in 75% of cases, the woman will eat the male as he's mating with her. So the male has developed a very interesting survival technique to avoid being eaten. During copulation, he can actually detach his genitals from his body so he can run away from being eaten by the female spider.
But it actually also prevents that female from copulating with another spider.
Yeah. What happens is his genitals get stuck inside her, and that therefore prevents any other males from mating with her for the next kind of, you know, few hours or however long it takes.
I think what interests me most about this is how this spider has evolved to have such a drive to reproduce that it will be seen as it's beneficial to detach its own genitals purely to reproduce.
I mean, it seems astounding that it's pretty much a one shot. that's all you get.
Yeah,
you get one go.
Yeah.
And most evolutionary strategies rely on the male sort of copulating with as many females as possible. And this is you get one go, and that's pretty much.
But you get a really good go. They found when they studied the spiders, they studied them in isolation, and they ended up having to check how much sperm was being transferred in when they detached their genitals versus when they didn't. And they found that actually this process of castrating themselves ended up transferring much more sperm to the female spider, making it much more likely that they would then get impregnated.
They actually counted the sperm.
They had this amazing technique. They had to remove the genitals of both spiders, so that is turning the frown back upside down again for those spiders. And they counted the sperm that they found under a microscope.
Should we move on? Should we move on to something slightly less easy to lose ourselves in? The Mona Lisa, Duncan.
This is very highbrow compared to the spider story.
So what's going on? They found a copy of the Mona Lisa, an original copy.
Why did you just ask me what's going on and then tell me what's going on? They found a copy of the Mona Lisa that was believed to have been painted in Leonardo's studio at pretty much exactly the same time as the original was being painted in Spain's National Art Museum, the Prado.
Okay, and this is, not to sound kind of facetious, but this is important. Why?
Well, it's important because obviously the Mona Lisa is probably one of the most famous paintings in the entire world, and we don't know very much about it at all. We know pretty much who painted it, but we don't know exactly who it depicts, we don't know who commissioned it, we don't even know exactly when it was painted. And it's hoped that information from this copy, which can be analysed much, much more closely than the original, can shed light on some of these questions.
Now, I think there is some fairly good evidence for who the person is in the image, isn't it? Like a cloth merchant.
Yeah, it's thought to be Lisa Gherardini, which is, as you say, the wife of a Florentine cloth merchant, but nobody can sort of know for sure. And getting a bit more information, there are certain areas of this copy that are better preserved than the original. And so being able to analyse those areas and get more information about how she's depicted might tell us some more information about who she is.
Now, this is going to go and sit in the Louvre, I think, as well. For the first time in over 500 years, the two paintings will be reunited. I mean, Liv, does that excite you? Is that a prospect that fills you with glee and delight?
It does. I'm a bit surprised that they're allowed to dig around on this copy. I know they're calling it a copy, but they don't know exactly when the last one was made. So maybe this is the original and they've got the copy behind the bulletproof glass in the Louvre.
That's entirely possible, I suppose. It's thought that that the person who painted the copy, although it's sort of an open question, it's thought that it's either Andrea Salai, who joined Leonardo's studio in 1490, or Francesco Melzi, who joined in 1506. And if it's the latter, then that could definitely have implications on when we think that the original was painted.
And how exactly did they find this painting?
Well, as I say, it was found in Spain's National Art Museum. It was hidden under this thick layer of black paint, and originally it didn't get much attention from the curators because it was thought to have been painted on oak, which wasn't really used in Italy at the time. But when they re-examined it last year, they found that it was actually painted on walnut wood, which prompted further investigation with x-rays and the discovery of this copy. And since then, they've been gently piecing off this layer of black paint that's on the top to leave the preserved copy underneath.
I don't say they just found a black painting and thought, maybe the Mona Lisa's under there.
Well, I don't think they thought maybe the Mona Lisa's under there. I mean, that was a big surprise for them. I think what they thought is, oh, I wonder what this is. You know, it's quite unusual to find something that's very much blacked out with paint. And so they wanted to investigate it a bit further. And when they did, they found something very surprising.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to debate the thorny issue of trust on the internet.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Olivia, Ms. Solon, this week the ASA, the Advertising Standards
Authority.
Thank you. Ruled on a case over TripAdvisor on the topic of, fake reviews, I think.
Yeah, I mean, TripAdvisor is a really popular reviews site, and a couple of hotels complained that there were fake reviews on TripAdvisor, and so it couldn't continue to claim that its reviews were honest and from real travellers, or at least not all of their reviews. And that's the kind of stuff that they put in all their advertising copy and all over their website. They have things like trusted advice from real travellers, more than 50 million honest travel reviews from real travellers. But the ASA upheld the complaint and said that TripAdvisor could not prove, you know, 100% that all of its reviews were trusted. And so now it's not allowed to say that its reviews are trusted or that they're from real travellers or were honest, which is quite a big deal for a review site.
So what can it say? Just that they are reviews?
No, they can say they have they do have trusted reviews, but they can't say all of our reviews are from real travellers. But I think this is a real problem. Like, TripAdvisor has got so much power now that hotels see it as really important for their livelihood to get good reviews. And that means that some kind of less scrupulous hotels are posting fake reviews and in some cases even paying for people to write favourable posts on TripAdvisor.
Or negative posts against the competition, I guess.
Exactly.
And this raised a debate in the office, which has come up before a number of times, about how best to essentially kind of liberate trust that you have established with one brand on the net, say a 5-year positive eBay rating, to a new site that also requires some kind of value of trust, like TripAdvisor or like any other sales website or even something like Match.com dating websites. You know, how should we be creating this inter-network metric of trust, if you like?
Yeah.
And you have some views on this, I know.
Well, this is something that a social innovator, I think is how she describes herself, called Rachel Botsman. It's a theory that she espouses, and it's this idea that we need some kind of online currency of trust, as you say. And the idea is that, you know, you might have built up a really strong reputation in eBay, you might have great reliability ratings on Airbnb, you might have done loads of trades with someone else on another marketplace, but then if you have no reviews on a separate marketplace, how can you bring some of that currency with you and show to someone that you're trustworthy on other places? Therefore, even though you've never used a service, you can still be trusted. I don't think there's an answer. I think it's something that needs to be created, and it's not about your clout score, that's for sure. It's about, you know, much more than that.
That's the thing. I think it has to be a very widespread, probably open source way of dealing with this, because if you entrust it to one company, then there's always going to be some way of, you know, that being biased. What's incredibly important is that other people trust the trust metric.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, is kind of, you know, who do you trust to entrust your trust with? I mean, do you know what I mean? I mean, there are obvious candidates. I mean, someone like Google, for example.
Yeah.
You know, you could put them in charge of your trust, but it would require that sites like eBay, like Match, like Airbnb, like TripAdvisor, that they all have some kind of a method of translating what is considered a positive trust on one site onto a positive ranking or rating or something on another site. And you know, who should control that, and what should that technology be?
Surely Facebook should be the people doing that, in that they already have your real identity, which is a huge component of trust. We've always talked about how people commenting with Facebook identities are a lot nicer than they are on the internet, because they're real people. So why not just take that? You've already got Facebook Connect, which is already in lots of transactions online. Why don't you use that as the metric?
I mean, I don't think that works, and I don't think Nate's suggestion of Google works either, because, as I say, both of these are private companies, well, public companies now in some cases, but they are both companies and will have some kind of bias to them. Sure, you can use your Facebook account to log into this, you know, independent thing that and you can tie in your Facebook account with it, but I don't think it should be Facebook that's running it.
So essentially, it should be some kind of decentralized API, in a sense.
Some kind of peer-to-peer thing would probably work very well.
Or someone that you trust with a lot of your finances already, a bank or Visa or MasterCard, potentially provide.
Again, like these are kind of services that we've seen be influenced by politics in the past. Things like Visa pulling donations from WikiLeaks is a very good example of that. You can't trust a company to be neutral, but just because it's a company.
But surely there should be an element of open data here. I mean, Google did something great. Facebook has relatively recently, allowed you to be able to download your personal data into an XML file. It's a non-proprietary file format for things like scraping your wall posts and comments and things like that. Perhaps rather than having some sort of centralized system, it could be something where you say, download my trust, and you essentially download a file, and you could upload that trust to another website. It raises the question of, well, you could edit that file, but perhaps there could be some sort of, you know,
you could have a verifications process.
I
mean, maybe like, yeah, exactly like that. In a very similar way that Bitcoin is built, and where all the transactions occur within the swarm, you could do exactly the same thing with trust. If you want to get your identity verified, you have to confirm the identity of two or three other people. And that can happen very, very fast in, you know, over a network.
I think it goes above just your identity. It's also about, with that identity, what kind of trust ranking you have.
So yeah, not being a murderer on Match.com doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be an honest or fast poster on eBay, you know, or having a really high Amazon marketplace account as a seller, I guess, doesn't necessarily mean that you aren't also a psychotic killing machine on a dating site. You know what I mean, right?
There's also the aspect of, right, today, I mean, this will change in the future, but today, still, the vast amount of people have never used Airbnb or, you know, Rent My Car or, you know, a lot of people have used eBay, but to be honest, I don't have an eBay feedback score.
But then there's, I guess, there's a big difference between getting a bad, you know, getting a dodgy deal on eBay where you don't get that goods that item that you paid for, and then having your flat trashed by some dodgy person staying there. I think, as we saw last year, there was an absolute horror story of a woman in San Francisco who had her apartment trashed, her stuff burnt, her identity stolen. And it's little cases like this, very rare cases, that prevent people from signing up to these services where they're trading with their peers their high value items.
I mean, maybe the place is for somebody to set up this is for a company to kind of insure your ability to operate on these sites. You know, somebody insures your Airbnb apartment if you make sure that everyone comes in has got a score above a certain level in this trust metric.
That's what Wonga does. Say companies like that, Wonga, Klarna in Sweden, just by looking at your online habits, they come up with a trust score on whether you're going to pay back that loan. That's very specific finance. Klarna's for finance invoice payments. There's so much information you can work out whether someone's trustworthy already. These companies do. Insurers have done it forever. The idea of collaborative consumption, I don't think, is new. It's a nice buzzword for it, but P2P is as old as society itself, and you always need trust mechanisms. What's changed is the scale. So if you rip someone off in a small town, you get a bad reputation in that town. You can't do it, and that's where everyone works. When it's on the internet, you can rip someone off and then move to a million other people without it ever getting around. That's where the problem comes in.
Essentially, it's like Skyrim. You can murder someone in one town, but you're fine in another.
Life is a bit like Skyrim.
I've always said that. And on that note, it's time to move on to talking about Tumblr. Tumblr. It's a website. Is it a blog? Is it a plane? No. So Tom Cheshire, you edit the play section of the magazine. You've been here for the last 20 minutes. I just want to throw some numbers out at you, which will explain why you're here. 42 million posts a day, 14 billion page views, valued at £500 million, and was started by a 25-year-old when he was 19.
David Karp, who's a New Yorker, very skinny, very shy. He started to code at 11, dropped out of high school, founded his first company when he was 15, went to Japan when he was 18 for a year, pretended to be a millionaire there. He basically couldn't blog. He found it too difficult to write for a long period of time, so thought there's got to be a better way of doing it. Came across Tumblr logging, which is this sort of stream of consciousness blogging movement where you see something nice, you put it up there. Just anything, quotes, videos. He built a platform for this because there was no other platform. Put it out. In 2 weeks, it got something like 75,000 users. And he's just taken it from there. So it's been going since February 2007, but in the last year, it's just rocketed enormously. David Karp's gone from being the sort of hipster internet rock star about town to a CEO who was one of the forefront of protesting SOPA, for instance. Barack Obama's now using Tumblr. The Occupy movement, the 99%, was a slogan that started as a Tumblr account. He's grown up with the site, and he's a very interesting individual and, like you say, much more successful than any of us.
He is. I mean, one of the things that interests me in your story is when he got an email from Richard Branson while he was on a plane. And the email said, a couple of things. Somebody mentioned that you might be keen to become an astronaut. If that was the case, let me know, and I'll put you in touch with David Clark at Virgin Galactic, who handles these things for us. That's not a bad email for a 25-year-old to get.
I want him to put me in touch with David Clark at Virgin Galactic.
Yeah. So why did you? What impression did you get of him? Like, is he taken aback by this success?
He's he's giddy with. I mean, that email was one he actually showed me. We're just talking. He's like, "Oh, you've got to look at this email. It's amazing." He's like, "Can I show you this email?" Yeah, I can show him the email.
2 weeks later, he's in the White House, and I think he said something like, "Okay, it's time to let this go to my head."
I mean, he did let it go to his head. In New York, which is a very tight media world, he became a bit of a superstar, appearing in glossy magazines, GQ, and Details, that sort of thing. But I mean, his view was, look, rock stars get a lot of press, you know, I'm a rock star of tech, we're all rock stars of tech, we should have the same attention. I think he's calmed down a bit more. He was going out partying, getting into the office really early and just burning at both ends. And now he's got a new girlfriend, he's got a dog with his girlfriend.
Dogs aren't expensive though, and this website's worth £500 million at a current valuation, which is incredible. It grew up essentially alongside Twitter with a similar sort of motive behind its creation. Short posts, they're reposted in their entirety.
Tumblr is a bit more about self-expression in that your blog can look how you want it to look. You can post any sort of content, images, videos, audio, quotes. The first guy who set up the first Tumblr blog, who's a 17-year-old high schooler in Germany, called Christian Neukirchen, and he described it as Obstalat, which is German for fruit salad. And it is kind of that raw mix. It's just everything, not filtered. You just have it, you consume it, and you keep doing it. The average Tumblr post gets reblogged 9 times, people just passing it on and on.
But with all this kind of like customization and everything, obviously Facebook was so successful and it was so able to take over from MySpace because it didn't have all this customization. People's profiles weren't just this glitzy ADHD mess of flashing cats and all kinds of things. Isn't there a danger that as Tumblr gets more popular, it's just going to descend into that same sort of world of animated GIFs and blinking text?
Carp's fascinated by MySpace. He only became fascinated by it later, and he's spoken to the guys, Krista Wolf, who founded it, see where they went wrong. I think it's two things. Management for MySpace. I think people have learned the lessons. MySpace was really pioneering. Second is just technically how it's built. MySpace is all put together as one thing. Tumblr separates the dashboard, which is the central newsfeed experience, with the blog, which you can personalize.
It's got loads and loads of users, but it doesn't take ads or anything. How's it going to make any money?
They're keeping shtum about it. They're not worried about it. They've got enough cash to burn through. They have issues with downtime a lot, but they're kind of working out. I think there are two ways they're going to go. One is this marketplace ecosystem that exists on top. So you can already buy Tumblr themes, which are just cosmetic, but there's no reason that couldn't introduce functionality. So an e-commerce button, say, or some sort of map API. Like, you could put anything you want on top of it and people could start charging for that, and Tumblr will take a 30% cut.
There's a lot of porn on there as well.
It's a great platform for porn, as David himself will say. When I was speaking to him about the porn issue, it kind of had the same thing as YouTube. YouTube had a lot of porn to start with and it became a problem. They got rid of it, more or less. David's not going to get rid of the porn. He thinks it's fine and it's not for them to make moral judgments. And he's kind of excited about it. When I was speaking with him about it, he's like, I mean, I love that there's this girl called Jessie Andrews, who I didn't know, who's a porn star who's won the Adult Video Network's Social Media Babe of the Year as a result of her use of Tumblr and Twitter.
Hell of an accolade.
Yeah, she's not safe for work, so watch out if you are Googling that. But it's great. It's an image-sharing platform, and I think it's really nice of him not say, I'm going to say this is wrong, you can't do it. Whereas Facebook, if it detects a certain amount of flesh in a photo, will take it down. It's just a platform for self-expression.
So Carp started learning to code for the web when he was 11. I doubt he learned that in school. Do you reckon that entrepreneurship like this kind of relies on learning the things they don't teach you in school?
No, I think it's just the bug to do your own company is the more important thing. For David, that meant he dropped out of high school when he was 14, 15. Zuckerberg dropped out of college because the company was there. I don't think it's a skills thing. I think it's just an appetite thing. Some people are happy taking that risk. Some people aren't.
Well, Tom, thanks very much for joining us. It's an amazing feature. I think it's on shelves now. You can buy it on the iPad or you can read it on the website, wired.co.uk. Next up, on a similar topic, we move our focus to this.
The era where we just spoon-feed facts to kids and call that an education is long since over.
That was Ray Kurzweil talking to us there. But why does he and others believe that era is over? It's time to find out. Katie, welcome to our trinket cupboard for a third time in a month.
Thank you very much.
Lucky devil. Now, it's come to my attention that the ICT education system in schools is fundamentally smashed and broken to pieces and needs rebuilding. kids know more than the teachers, something I can attest to, when the fact that, you know, I could edit HTML when I was being told to use some old program called FrontPage to build websites. But anyway, there is a conference you've been to that aims to change that.
Yeah, I went to a conference called Learning Without Frontiers, and there were lots of people saying exactly the same as you've said, that kids are using better technology and using it in their everyday life, and then coming to the classroom and being presented with utter tosh.
And being bored out of their ever-loving minds.
Indeed.
More to the point.
Indeed. The conference is called Learning Without Frontiers, and they have some amazing people there. So Jimmy Wales, Malcolm McLaren in the past, and this year Noam Chomsky, which I was very excited about. And it also comes off the back of the Gove speech at the BET conference, where Michael Gove said, ICT education is rubbish, we recognise that. Let's get the industry involved and let's change things. But what people were saying at the conference was, that's all fair and well, but, you know, what's actually happening? We need to change our notion of what education is. And the guy who founded the conference, Graham Martin Brown, I managed to catch him afterwards.
Who was expelled from school, I think, himself.
He was chucked out of school. And, I managed to catch up with him, and here's what he had to say.
Looking at the educational software, and it was absolutely shit. It was bad enough when I was, you know, in the 80s, but in the 21st century, you know, when kids have been, I mean, it's the only century my daughter's ever known. You know, she's been brought up with YouTube and Google and, you know, Harry Potter level animation. And then you put them in front of this sort of chocolate coated broccoli software. Take kids like Jeff Davis from Lulzsec. I mean, those kids didn't learn that stuff at school. They learned it by, you know, putting off, you know, open source software like Python and Ruby and scripting and so on, and figuring it out for themselves and realizing they can bring down News International. Fantastic. I mean, if I was 14, I would have done that. Do you know what I mean?
So basically what Brown Martin is saying is that he believes that the technological disruption that's happened in every other aspect of our lives has just not filtered into schools. And he said that initiatives such as the Khan Academy are just old wine in new bottles. But there won't be change until we answer one very basic question.
Which is?
What's education?
Until we answer that, you know, all we're doing is what we've been doing is throwing technology into education, whether it's schools or universities, to reinforce 19th century and 20th century teaching practice.
Another of the attendees at the conference was one Ian Livingston.
He's life president at Eidos, the company that makes Tomb Raider games, and was the co-author of the Next Gen report on ICT education, who's actually written a really great guest post for Wired.co.uk the other week.
Indeed. Well, I grabbed him on the phone after the conference, and he said that he agreed with Graham that the education system in general is pretty staid.
Yeah, education hasn't really changed much in the last 150 years. The way one person stands at the front of a group of people and talks at them requires of them to remember facts and figures and regurgitate them to order to pass an exam seems very outdated, because the way that children consume media has changed radically within the last 5 to 10 years.
So what do we need to do to change this system?
Well, I caught up with inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil, who delivered a talk at the conference and talked to me afterwards about how he believes we need to be fostering learning, giving children the tools to be able to solve bigger problems instead of making schools into just factories.
The era where we just sort of spoon-feed facts to kids and call that an education is long since over. What we really need to teach kids is how to solve problems, how to understand knowledge itself, how to find knowledge, how to apply it to real-world situations. Entrepreneurship, I think, is the best way to learn that. I co-founded a school called Singularity University. It's sponsored by Google and NASA, where we use entrepreneurship as an educational tool. But the idea is that you learn best by actually solving problems and having a passion for your project.
Kurzweil's argument, basically, is that we should be bringing real-world problem-solving into the classroom.
Which is something Ian Livingston said as well.
He did, yeah. He said that we should be letting children use the tools that they play with outside of the classroom into the classroom, something you mentioned from your school days. Mm. But he's also saying that we should be getting those who are involved in the tech industry and the gaming industry and get them to contribute to the curriculum. And this was a key point in the Next Gen report. But Ian says he's actually really optimistic of change now.
The fact that our report was published in February last year, and in less than a year, the Secretary of State is announcing that the current programme of study of ICT is going to be withdrawn. It's an extraordinary achievement.
Now, Conrad Wolfram of Wolfram Alpha fame was also there to argue the cause for not just ICT.
No, he was saying that maths education is also fundamentally flawed, and I caught up with him after he'd given his talk.
We've not only got to get the way in which we learn and teach right, we've also got to get the actual subject matter right. And the subject matter of mathematics has fundamentally changed, so that in the outside world you do the calculating with computers most of the time, and in the classroom we've kind of banned them most of the time from the calculating. Unless we change that, this chasm will persist. Politicians in particular are pretty confused about what the subject of maths is, and in particular the fact that it's changed so much in recent decades. You know, computers fundamentally changed the subject of maths in the outside world because they allowed, you know, calculating to be, you know, liberated so that you could actually do as much calculating as you want in most cases. That hasn't changed in education, and so we're basically spending 80% of the time teaching the wrong piece of the subject. We shouldn't be getting students to be third-rate computers. But here's what I'd like to see going forward, that we have a completely reformed subject of mathematics in schools that is computer-based, for the most part, except where Hancock is really practically useful, and that Britain can leapfrog the rest of the world in leading this charge forward, because I think whichever country does it first will massively improve how STEM happens and also people's general understanding in everyday life of how to use mathematics and what it can do for them.
So Katie, with all of this in mind, what is your takeaway from this conference?
Well, I think there's exciting times ahead, especially for ICT education, because people are now starting to listen to the likes of Ian Livingston. But what I'm wondering is whether or not this could prompt changes in the system as a whole, mm-hmm. which would be absolutely amazing. Dame Ellen MacArthur was also at the event. She gave a talk, and she was talking about circular economy theory, where, you know, everything in a product is reused and fed back into the system. And she was saying, relating back to education, that, you know, that could offer huge opportunities for entrepreneurship and innovation in schools. So, you know, it's not just about changing ICT education, changing maths education. It really is about changing what we think education is for, mm-hmm. and hopefully engaging kids more than they are being engaged at the moment.
Cool. So I know you've written a feature as well on the back of Ellen MacArthur's circular economy angle,
yeah,
which I think is on the site now.
It is, and there's also a wealth of features from the conference.
There certainly is, and you can find those at wired.co.uk. Do a search for ICT, I think. And thanks, Katie. And that's the end of our show. Duncan, it's the end again.
Again.
Liv, again.
Every week it's the end of the show.
Very sad, very sad.
And only for the second time it's the end for Tom. Liv, tell us how people can get in touch.
Well, as ever, you can catch us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK, or you can like us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/WiredUK.
And Tom, would you like to read out the podcast email address if people want to ask us any questions?
You can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
And we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.